Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we're turning to the topic of trying to own our past. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, the ancient relic of the past and unfortunately still part of my present, Martin McMahon. Martin, how are you?
Not too bad, Tony. I'm not that old, Tony. God almighty, give it a break.
It's not that you're that old. It's the years you've put on me.
You actually, those years were on you before I got here, Tony.
Much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined in the Tortoise Shack by senior news reporter with the Irish Examiner, and for my money, one of the best journalists and writers on the topic of owning our past, of mother and baby homes, and adoption stories. And you know what, folks? It's not often you get to have these conversations and have people who've given 10 years of their life to writing about it. So Conal O'Farrell, Conal. Thank you so much for making the effort to come here today. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Glad to be here.
I'm going to kick us off because, you know, as these things, there always seems to be an anniversary of something or other as we're going along. And this Saturday marks the 20th anniversary of the state apology to the survivors of institutional abuse and the 10th anniversary of the publication of the Ryan Report. So, yeah. Have we come on at all?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, I think we have in some regards, but I think in other ways, it's a kind of a theme of what I write about is that we seem to have a succession of scandals around the treatment of women and children predominantly since, you know, the foundation of the state, really.
Yeah.
And I've written about this a lot. I mean, I didn't write a lot. I wasn't a reporter at the time of States of Fear. Certainly, you know, people like Mary Raftery were kind of one of the reasons I got into journalism. But we tend to compartmentalize all these things as individual scandals. And I've written that a lot. And I mean, I see mother and baby homes adoption as the same story. I think these are all part of a common thread, which is how we treat women and children. But instead of maybe confronting that head on and saying, you know, that there's a kind of almost an inbuilt misogyny into what the Irish state was founded on, we tend to kick it all down the road as long as possible. And until a scandal is forced out into the public, we then box that one away and we treat that one as an individual scandal, deal with that through, you know, whatever means we deem necessary, which is usually a state inquiry and a redress scheme that's then becomes controversial for years and years and years after the fact. And we move on to the next one. So we had, you know, we look at the Magdalen laundries like they're different to the mother and baby homes in terms of essentially being about the same thing. Women who didn't fit the social ideal and their children. And I still view the industrial schools, all of that, as part of that same process. Mm. And I think, you know, the mother and baby homes issue will only deal with one part of what is a wider story, which I think is largely about adoption and forced and legal adoption. So I think while we have learned things, I think we're confronting them. Certainly, I think the wider public sees them for what they are. But I think in terms of how the state handles things, I think we're still just doing the same thing. At a glacial pace.
Would you view the apology then as the apology from 20 years ago as a sincere apology?
That's a tough one. I think they are. But I mean, I think oftentimes with how we handle issues, and I mean, speaking from the one state apology that I suppose I covered being the Magdalen laundry apology, I do think it was a sincere apology. But I mean, what comes after that is what's actually important. And that's how do we actually address the apology in terms of how we treat the survivors. And I mean, the Magdalen redress scheme has been nothing short of scandalous.
Yes.
So I mean, but I think oftentimes the media, and I'm not having a cut at the media, you know, I work for it. Once there's an apology, that's the high point. And then not everyone keeps with it after the fact and sees, well, what is the redress scheme looking like? Who's been treated badly here? You know, and that's the same with the survivors of, you know, industrial schools. You look at the Carinua scheme, which, I mean, to my own detriment, I haven't done enough on. I've done bits and bobs. But again, there wasn't a huge amount of media coverage of that. There has been, I know people like Ellen Coyne has done good stuff on that as well. But I mean, that's, to me, is where we should be, is that once an apology happens, that's a great moment, but that's their words.
Yeah.
Actions then are what matter after the fact. I think it's incumbent upon journalists anyway to follow up on how schemes are implemented, how people are treated.
The damage limitation comes in from the legal people once the politicians have apologised. Then it goes to the lawyers and it's all damage limitation then after that.
Yeah, and I mean, like often, I can't remember the guy who said it. I think it was Nigel Rodley in the UN said, you know, that the Irish way of doing things is, you know, you ignore something, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, you ignore it. Then when you have to deal with it, you know, it's kicked down the road as long as possible. Then there's an apology. And then essentially you pay people off and you buy silence through redress schemes that essentially require confidentiality.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is...
Which is not real transparency. For justice to be done, it has to be seen to be done. And what we've seen in the case of the Magdalens, we've seen where they've been asked to sign away these. It's essentially they're not even being told that they're being given compensation. It's more at the gift of the state to pay these funds across. On the basis that you kind of then you just forget about it now,
and you waive your rights to take a legal challenge or whatever. And that's, I mean, I know Maeve O'Rourke and people like her have really spoken on that. We just do things the wrong way. This isn't the way to address issues like this. And I know even doing stuff on the laundries. I mean, I've spoken to people who were in industrial schools and who'd been through that process as well. And I mean, they've told me like. They talk about the treatment before the redress committee. I mean, as horrific. I've had people break down having to recount how awful an experience that was, how confrontational it was. Again, these are all things that aren't really addressed or covered a lot in the media because they're, I suppose, they're difficult to write about because people aren't entitled to speak out publicly about what happened there. But I mean, I think issues like that show that that process is often as damaging are certainly damaging to people as the original abuse was.
Re-traumatizing people.
Yeah.
So if we're saying that, just to give us an idea, you've got the apology, you're now going to partake in a particular scheme. What other hurdles are you talking about here?
I mean, in what sense? In terms of if
you want to actually go ahead and avail of the money that is actually...
Well, I mean, in terms of the Magdalen redress scheme, that's something I spent, like, I mean, since the apology, which is 2013, I was writing about the redress scheme for like 5 years before the Ombudsman's report, because I wrote about the Ungreenon training centre, which was attached to the High Park Laundry in Dublin here in Drumcondra. And all of the girls who worked in Ungreenon worked in the laundry. Mm. They were children. This was known as a training centre where people were, you know, taught basic skills, typing, sewing, all the rest. But all those girls had to work in the laundry. They were refused admission to the redress scheme because essentially the way the Department of Justice interpreted the scheme was that you had to be admitted to and worked in a laundry. So they didn't disagree that the girls worked in the laundry, but they felt they weren't admitted to the laundry. They were admitted to Ungreenon, which again is, it's about as narrow an interpretation of the wording as you can get. So I remember just thinking this was insane, you know, and I got a cache of documentation, some of it which became quite well known about the mother and baby homes in terms of what was known in 2012 prior to Catherine Corliss's revelations within the HSC. And part of that cache was information pertaining to Ungreenon, because all of this was happening at the time of the McAleese inquiry. And essentially the HSC uncovered evidence that Ungreenon and High Park were one and the same thing. That was the words they used, essentially one and the same thing. And I mean, to me, I think I have it in one of my pieces, the exact timeline. That went before a representative of the McAleese committee, and it was essentially just left. Ungreenon was then removed as one of the institutions that they were going to investigate, because Ungreenon was dealt with by the previous commission, which looked at industrial schools. A group of women had taken High Court challenge through Wendy Lyon and some other solicitors, basically stating that their refusal to get redress was unfair. They went to the Ombudsman. Ombudsman ruled actually against them initially. And then I provided this evidence to their legal representatives. I spoke to Wendy and I said, look, I've seen what you're doing trying to help these women, and this piece of documentation I have would seem to be pretty key, because it's essentially the HSE saying that they're the same institution. Yes. And that all of the girls that were in Ungreenon worked in the laundry. That court case proceeded, but the Ombudsman decided to judicially review that decision. And then off the back of that, eventually the wheel started in motion towards the Ombudsman launching a full investigation of the redress scheme, which, you know, was pretty big news at the time.
Yeah.
Found it was maladministered, that, you know, the department was relying on the word, sometimes the word of the order over the word of women, without providing any documentary evidence. So you essentially, to cut a long story short, I mean, to even describe that process takes a couple of minutes, but I mean, you're talking years of these people's lives to get.
That was 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that's, and I mean, there's still an issue I've been writing about it the last few months about, so the scheme was eventually amended to be widened to include all of these institutions like Ungreenon. And then you had a group cohort of 14 women who were in Ungreenon past 1980. And the department, while it hadn't refused their application, it was basically saying that there was an issue over this because the order was saying no girls from Ungreenon worked in the laundry post 1980. The women had said categorically, that's not the case. We all worked there post 1980. So Wendy Lyme was dealing with these women as well, and they had written to the department saying, you know, can you provide us the evidence of which this is being based on? The department refused. So these women were essentially being just strung along. So I started to write about that also. And one of the reasonings I had heard that the women had suspected was that the order had told the department that there was a laundry constructed in Ungreenon in 1980, which negated the need to send any of the girls to the main laundry. Now, I mean, two key issues here. I mean, if you constructed a laundry in Ungreenon, which was so the girls who were there could wash their own clothes,
yeah,
that's not the same as a commercial laundry, which High Park Magdalen Laundry was. So, I mean, the two things are totally different. And secondary to that, I mean, I had actually documentation which shows that the laundry they mentioned wasn't constructed until 1984, and the order was reimbursed by the state for that laundry. So, I mean, little old me had evidence to show that if that was a reason, there's documentary evidence to prove that that was not the case.
Yes.
And yet, you know, this process seemed to just drag on and drag on and drag on. And of course, I put it out in the newspaper, and I think they were on drive time as well. And then lo and behold, the department has now changed that because there was a lot of publicity around it. But I mean, these women shouldn't have to.
And is that the only thing that changes the course of how these things run? Is it the publicity? Is that the only thing that you, I mean, talking reason doesn't seem to work. If you have the evidence that it's not the case, you present the evidence, you would think that it would be taken on board. But then you have to go further and write about it and expose it to the wider public before any action is taken.
Yeah, yeah. And that's not me saying, you know, the media is great and we're the reason that all this stuff gets out. I think publicity generally helps. But in saying that, I've been writing about illegal adoptions and illegal birth registrations for years. And I mean, they were only discovered apparently by the department as an issue last year. So, I mean, I said that at something that the minister was at, and I made a point of it. I mean, you know, this isn't new.
This is potentially one of the, I know this is a bad phrase, but the biggest can of worms that exists in Ireland is the adoption.
Yeah.
Went on and what we think went on. And, you know, there are absolutely indicators that children, we were told children were dead and they were adopted. And those indicators exist. Now, there's been no investigation. There's been no real digging into this yet, except from academics and people like yourself.
Yeah. Like, I mean, the funny thing, like, I think adoption and forced and legal adoption and the processes used to remove children from women that were through various systems, whether it be mother and baby homes or individual adoption agencies, which bear in mind aren't part of the current investigation, only if they're linked in some way to a mother and baby home, which again goes back to the kind of misunderstanding of the wider issue that is not about individual institutions. Since I've started writing about this, I've said that this is the issue that ties it all together. I think this is the issue that the state is most worried about. I don't think they're particularly worried about the deaths of children that happened, you know, decades ago. I think they, you know, again, I'm a big believer in how narrative is kind of constructed and, you know, kind of owned. And I think that the hidden kind of elephant in the room here is adoption, because I think, you know, the state will have large questions to answer about how adoption orders were contracted, questionable consents, falsification of consents, which I've written about a lot. And I mean, even to take it back, the first story I wrote about, I mean, people always ask me why I've started writing about this. And I mean, I knew nothing about adoption. I knew nothing about any of this history. I did history in college. I had no interest in studying women's history, shall we say. It didn't interest me at all. And I mean, I had done a story on the waiting times that potential adoptive parents had to go through, essentially, to be approved to adopt abroad, which was just a story that came my way, wrote it. And I was reading Oireachtas committee hearings way like back in 2009. And it was to do with previous legislation they were trying to bring in 2005. And I came across Susan Lohan from the Adoption Rights Alliance before an Oireachtas committee hearing. I didn't know her from Adam, but I read it and she had spoken about illegal adoptions and how no one was, you know, looking at this and why is this an issue we're banging the drum on and no one cares. And so I was like, 25, 26 at the time. So I said, you know, there's a story, I'll ring her up. So I rang her up and she said, look, you're the first reporter to have rung me on this in years and years and years. So I said, look, will you meet me? I'd be keen to know what it's all about. And I went to Dublin and she had bumped into a woman who had who was worked with Adoption Loss, which is a group that represents natural mothers. And she just happened to bump into her on the street and I met Susan and this other lady. And they told me, the other lady told me about the case of Tressa Reeves, which was a pretty high profile case last year. And, you know, that Tressa had given birth in England. Her parents were Irish. She was sent home. She went through St. Patrick's Guild, which facilitated the illegal birth registration of her son. And essentially his history was falsified. And yeah. She had spent years trying to find him. I couldn't believe this. This was like nuts to me. I was going, Jesus, like that's insane, you know? And now like the case of Tress's case, while bad, seems just so common. And I've had multiple other cases where the documentation just looks like so far out there that you can't even believe what you're looking at. So I said, I'd love to write about her. I went and interviewed Tressa, wrote the story, and then like, that was it. You know, I started on this and the more I got phone calls from loads of people. And I mean, as soon as that story went out, I knew I would be writing about this for possibly the rest of my career. I knew that like there was thousands more people potentially like Tressa. She was just, you know, a sample of what was a wider issue. And I mean, that's the first story I wrote about St. Patrick's Guild. And it took another... what is it like? So I wrote that story in 2010, took another 8 years for St. Patrick's Guild to finally land on the radar. But again, that was the whole point of narrative, is that like I was writing about St. Patrick's Guild consistently since then. Tress's story eventually led to the Adoption Authority to audit their own records, where they found 90 cases of illegal registrations suspected. They reported that to the department in 2011. In 2013, they reported it again to the department. In 2015, they sent three separate reports on illegal registrations, including a spreadsheet of cases and a commentary on some of the cases. And then in 2018, we have the minister stand up saying this is the first time we've had a high threshold of evidence of illegal birth registrations. And that's simply because the St. Patrick's Guild 126 cases are marked with a post-it note, like that said adopted from birth. But I mean, and as I've said, I mean, the department has argued, oh, well, these were categorical. We were certain these were illegal registrations. Where what the Adoption Authority provided us with was suspicions of illegal registration. But so, I'm like, but the Adoption Authority is the regulatory body for adoption in this country. It is surely when they say it, you should be thinking there's an issue here.
But sometimes they don't want the answer.
Well, this is it. And I mean, again, this is how narrative is so important to me. And I suppose sticking with a story is that I had a lot of information to go back on where I could say, well, no, this isn't the truth of how this is happening. Right. You know, while you might have found these 126 cases about St. Patrick's Guild, you know, some of us know that this has been going on for a while and have been saying it for quite a while, including the Adoption Authority, who I have no great grasp for and have written very critically of. But they were reporting the issue and they were saying, speculating that there could be thousands of these cases, and you know, essentially pushing the door at the department to say, if this needs to be looked at, you need to look at it.
Well, we did learn in the very recent past that if you don't fill out the correct form that you're not actually saying anything. It's, you know, it can be ignored unless it's on the correct headed form. And I wonder what the correct headed form is for illegal adoptions.
Yeah, like that's the frustrating thing is that, you know, again, I knew, like writing about legal registrations, you kind of knew that, like the first, after Tress, I'd written a lot about St. Patrick's Guild, and most of this stuff got very little traction, you know, like I'll give you an example. When the whole Tuam thing broke, all of this became far more into the public consciousness about, you know, obviously there's the deaths and there's the issue at Tuam, but then the wider issue of adoption kind of started to come on. And I remember the 9 o'clock news on RTE had done a story on the Bessborough of records, and that they had transferred whatever it is, 15,000 records or 20,000 records to the state in 2011. And this was like, wow, like there's thousands more records and the state has them. And I was going, I was writing about the transfer of those records in 2011, multiple times, like, you know, continually talking about the difficulties about that transfer and how the HSC had sought indemnity on the records because there was concerns over previous actions of the how adoptions were contracted in Bessborough and they didn't want to take ownership of records without indemnity and all the rest. And you're kind of going, I live in a parallel universe here because now it's a story, whereas it wasn't then.
Yeah.
But I mean, I suppose that's the nature of the, I suppose, the job in one sense, but also how kind of something becomes part of a narrative is kind of out of your hands.
It captures the public's consciousness.
Yeah,
It is a very difficult thing to do. Like we've, I know it's not even at all equivalent, but we had like people talking about now these co-living units that are going to be 16 square meters and they're effectively the size of a car park. So, but it was last August, Orla Hegarty was talking about it and it was Lorcan Sir was talking about it and it never became news. And then Johnny Ronan takes out an ad about these giant things in a national newspaper and it becomes news.
Yeah.
But this is much more serious than this. This goes back to the state, since its inception, continually punishing women and children for not conforming to the societal norms, we shall call them politely. We're living through this period again. We're living through the echoes of homeless hubs, the echoes of direct provision. We're seeing these things now where the historian, feminist historian Mary McAuliffe sat where we are sitting now and told us that we warehouse the poor, and we always have. Except we didn't just warehouse the poor, we actually warehoused them and then we actually sold off the, my words again, not yours, but we sold the children off into other homes where, you know, off to America, off to the UK.
Well, it was always money-making schemes like the laundry. And we have great suspicions that what happened with the babies was money-making schemes as well. And the only thing that's really changed now is that the mother and children are the money. They're the ticket. They're the meal ticket. And there's privateers making money off their misery. But that's no different to what happened in the Magdalene laundries. It's no different what has happened since the inception of the state. And what you were saying about the state having this internalized misogyny, maybe it's that dealing with that means you also have to deal with your present as well as with your past.
Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting. You talk about like the present and the past, whereas I certainly place this story, like one of the things that gets thrown at me is like, oh, it happened years ago, you know, you know, it's a different Ireland and all the rest. And but even on this, like this, the stuff that I write about is very much part of the present, because like, I mean, these people, the people who came through mother and baby homes and were adopted are adults now demanding answers, and they're demanding access to their own personal information, most of which is held by the state, and they're being denied that information. I mean, I don't know how many times I get contact people saying, you know, I've tried to get this information out of Tusla, my personal information, I'm not able to get it. They're citing GDPR, they're citing third party information. And it's curious because particularly to deal with illegal birth registrations, people forget none of those people were legally adopted. So there's no legislation to prevent them accessing their own information.
Like,
the Tusla keeps saying, well, these are adoption records. They're not, because no adoption happened in these cases.
Yeah.
And to take it another step, I mean, I wrote a story a few months ago about a woman who had an alias in the piece called Jackie Foley. That was the alias I gave her. And she was in Bessborough in 1974, and she was told to sign a name that was not her own on the consent form. To the extent that she said, I had to look up at my mother and say, how do you spell this? She didn't know how to spell the name. So all of the documents that were preceded that, including the registration of her son's birth, the adoption order, are all falsified. The birth, the baptismal record, the adoption order are all in the name of a woman and a boy who don't exist. So if her son, who's, you know, 1974, I don't know what that makes him now.
45.
If he's to access his birth certificate, which is still not a legal right that he has in this country as an adopted person.
Yeah.
And he sees that name, he will search for a woman who does not exist. And that's bad enough. And then I had access to emails that she had gotten via TUSLA, via an FOI process, which in and of itself was exhaustive, where you have senior management in TUSLA advising social workers and FOI officers dealing with their case to not refer to it as an illegal birth registration, but to refer to it as a possible illegal birth registration. And, you know, there's an over and back, and one of the people on the email chain says, you know, this is a bit, why are we, you know, seems a bit pedantic. And the response from a social worker is, I think it's a case, you know, I'm paraphrasing again, of us holding our powder in case this woman takes a legal challenge.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the past and the present right there.
Yeah.
So, and I've written this, I said, while women like Jackie were ignored when they were essentially children, now they're feared. And, you know, they're trying to silence her a different way now. And I mean, that to me just struck a chord, because I said, this is not an old story. This is a contemporary story. Mm. A woman like Jackie is being treated as badly now by the state as she was when she was a child and forced to sign a false name on a consent form. And it just blew my mind that this is how the state is handling cases like this, saying we better keep this, you know.
But you say the state, but who is making these decisions? Who is saying this is the way we will treat this?
Well, this is coming down from senior management within TUSLA that, you know, again, the fear always is legal action. And I still think that is the fear about everything to do with adoption, is the fear of how much this will potentially cost in the long run. Because if people start to take legal cases, where does it end? Because how many people are impacted? And it's the sheer scale of numbers. I mean, when Tressa settled her case, a couple of months ago, that was a significant moment, because there are loads of people out there like Tressa, and that's just illegal birth registrations. That's before you actually delve into people who have adoption orders. Like in Jackie's case, there is an adoption order. The state signed off on that adoption as a legal adoption. And in fact, the response from the adoption authority in their emails is that not only is it not an illegal adoption, it's a legal adoption because an adoption order exists, even though all of the names, all of the paperwork is fraudulent. And you can be guaranteed that that's one woman in one adoption agency. So, I mean, if you broaden it out and you forensically audit everything, what are you going to find? And I think there is a very real fear that this could potentially be the largest church state scandal that we have. Just my opinion. Totally wrong. But I hope someone looks at it, because I sure as hell can't, you know, do that. You know, I can't audit every record. I can't. But I mean, everything that I write about, and it points that way. It points that this is potentially huge. The adoption authority themselves have speculated that the illegal birth registrations alone could number thousands.
In a lot of cases of the people you've spoken to, is compensation what they're after, or is it they just want to get to the truth?
No, I've never met anyone. Anyone who ever contacts me to write their story wants to expose what happened to them. And they want, they just want their records.
Yeah.
That's all they want. They don't want compensation. They want basic tracing rights. They want to own their own information. They want their medical histories. That's all they want. And they want an acknowledgement of what happened, which is where people say state apologies aren't worth anything. I think they are. You know, I think it does matter to people that there's an acknowledgement of that. And I mean, there will be a state apology for forced and legal adoption. It's impossible that it won't happen. The question is when it's going to happen.
Now, there's two ways of accessing information. You have FOI and you have data protection to access information. We know with what's been happening with FOI recently that it's been really been gutted, and it really is being gutted. And we know that, and these are my words, not yours, data protection commissioner's office is captured. It does bloody nothing. It's absolutely bloody useless. So the two Well, we've
seen very recently where the Data Protection Commissioner on a simple ruling, the HSC, in a matter of someone, how do you spell my name? And, you know, you have a couple of fodders yourself, Conal. So you're not actually entitled. There's no, you have no full entitlement to how your name is spelled.
Yeah.
That is just one situation. We know we are supposed to be the Data Protection Commissioner in effect for some of the biggest.
But if they can't handle something, and I don't mean it's small, but on a global scale, adoptions in Ireland are nowhere near managing your Facebooks and your Googles for data. And if they can't address that in timely manner, timely, not decades, weeks, weeks is what these things should be dealt with. And if the Data Protection Commissioner was worth his salt, would be fighting exactly what it's meant to do, protect the data of the individual. And stop this compromise malarkey that they're at constantly at this compromise malarkey. Do what you're meant to do. But it's taken the two tools that individuals have. And they're really the only two tools short of going to a courtroom to access information. And they've whipped them away and they've bastardized them and they've eunuched them and they've made them absolutely useless.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly on... from what I write about, like, access to information is, like I said this before, like, it's everything to a journalist. I mean, unless you can prove anything and access documentation, you know, you can't write it. And like, FOI is one of the key tools that most journalists use. And I mean, I don't know how many journalists have been in here, but
a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I'd probably guess that none of them have said FOI is getting easier or getting, yeah, it's getting worse. In my, I'm what, 10 years really a reporter. I would say, in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, it has become far more stringent. It's far more difficult to get anything approaching. You don't get anything back on time. There's so many ways to drag it out. So you don't get who's dealing with the FOI request. Then you're making phone calls to try and find the person. Then you get them. Then you don't get a response within the relevant time period. Then you go to try and internally review the decision to try and move that along. And you're chasing. And then you get, you know, a refusal. Then you got to go through the process of appealing that. I mean, it was never good, but it's suddenly moved the other way.
Well, you've seen the recent judgment with the guys from Right to Know and how the rigmarole they went through. And that failed.
Yeah.
That was a dark day for journalism.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, there are great people doing almost exclusively FOI work. And, they, you know, without those, some of the biggest scandals in the state would not have come to light.
And it's not sexy to say it, like, but I know certainly colleagues we've spoken about, like, there's probably a kind of an expose to do on FOI, you know, but it's not a sexy subject. But like a lot of what you read, that's stuff that doesn't want to be out there. That's how you get it. You know?
I can't wait for it to become a story, and we'll have the exact same thing which you said. Ken Fox will be going, I've been writing about this for years.
Yeah,
you know,
and he has. Yeah,
once a month, he puts up his his FOI for Dummies on social media, and every once a month he gets another few people who go realize and familiarize themselves. But it is the basis of a lot of the work that you do.
And like, you just have to be, I mean, I was asked to speak at something in UCC about FOI, and it was at a law class, and I just can't, the name of the person who asked me in, she was involved in, she's very involved in FOI and some of the panels involved in it. And I mean, I just put up, for the hour that I was there, I discussed one FOI request that I did that took over a year just to get an answer.
Well,
and I said, like, that's ridiculous, you know, and that's, I say to any journalist that I've asked, speak to young journalists, I say, like, the way to get anywhere in FOI is just be a dogged, like, obstinate bastard on it, because that otherwise you'll get nowhere. You just have to. I mean, I used to do, you know, the FOI officer might ring you and have a chat with you. I don't do anything on the phone anymore. I do everything on paper through experience, where I can go back and say, well, hang on, 2 months ago you told me this. I mean, it shouldn't be like that. It shouldn't be as confrontational as it is. And unless you've worded something the exact right way, it'll be, you know, they'll find some gap to go through.
Well,
and some departments are better than others. Some people are quite good. Other people are terrible. Like I said this before, on all of the adoption stuff that I've done, like, I was accessing records to do mother and baby homes pretty easily through the HSE and Tuesday. You know, I understand there are things you can't get. And then lo and behold, since a lot of this stuff started to get more traction, I mean, I get nothing now. Mm. Nothing.
Yeah. Now, FOI is a great tool for journalists, but for the individual who is looking for their records, the tool that they have available, the best tool they have available to them is data protection.
Yeah.
In that you have an absolute right to control of your data.
Well, you've a right to a copy of any information people have recorded about you.
Yeah,
and that is a simple essay or your standard access request that you want to do. Anything you have relating to me, what is the charge, 650 or 635? Yeah. Send it in, pay your money, and they've 30 days to comply.
Actually, the charge is gone now with GDPR. The charge is gone. And now Simon McGarrah was writing about this recently. The very basic of what's my information have you got on me? And I want to see that information. That's the basic purpose of your data protection office.
Mm.
And that's the one thing they're not fulfilling. It's the one thing that's almost impossible to get them to do.
Yeah.
And I mean, what's the point in having it?
Well, I mean, and like it is probably the key phone call I get on adoption related material now. Like you asked me about, do people ring saying there should be redress for this? Virtually no one. It is all about how impossible it is to access their own information.
Yeah.
That's the thing. They're not looking for, I'll give you an example. I've asked Tusla about the recent 126 cases. So all of these people were given a name, were obviously contacted by Tusla to say, by the way, the name on your birth cert is not what you were intended to be called by your mother.
Mm.
The people who you think were your parents are not actually, in fact, your parents. Your birth was legally registered and it was a informal, as they like to call it, adoption. I had said, like, have all of those people should be entitled to say, well, what was my original name?
Yes.
That's their information. And I've asked that question. You cannot get an answer as to whether or not they're releasing that information. Because I have no doubt the fear is, well, if we release this, Jesus, they could go calling to, Joan Murphy might get a knock on her door. But that is not the concern, in my opinion, of the state. I mean, first of all, it presupposes that everyone is going to turn up on people's doorsteps and demand. And that just doesn't happen. It just doesn't. These people are rational adults that want information that pertains to them that they have a right to. I know Fred, you've spoken to Fred Logue. God knows, he'd probably tell you chapter and verse in this. But to me, it is astonishing that basic personal information cannot be released to people.
It is astonishing. It is astonishing.
Yeah.
It's absolutely astonishing. And it's astonishing that the two arms that are there to help people have really quite silently been gelded.
Yeah. And I mean, in terms of the adoption records, it goes back to what I say. I think the fear is that open records, people got if tomorrow we opened everything up and everyone got their records, is what are we opening?
Well, I mean, they put them into the 75 years.
Yeah.
They want to seal the records for 75 years.
I've written a lot
years.
About that as well. And I mean, again, it's one of the weird ones that got practically no coverage. I remember when the minister announced it, I went to the news desk and said, Jesus, this is, I knew it had, obviously it had been in the ether for quite a while, but I said, like, this is, bonkers, so I rank Trina Crowes, former head of special projects in the National Archives. I knew she was very vocal on this and I got her to comment on it. I mean, she correctly said there is no reason why this can't be done within the current National Archives Act. And I still have not seen
the reason.
Any reason.
Well, the reason is we want everybody dead.
Well,
that is the reason. You can't sue if you're dead.
Well, like, why 75 years? I mean, they're saying it's for retention of records. So this is the only way to retain them. So for example, in for people who were through the commission to inquire into child abuse, that they were given statutory guarantees of confidentiality. Fine. That's all fine. But as Katrina Groh has said, and others have said, well, that does not preclude you from redacting records, giving people a copy of their own, redacting the rest. This is how we do things. There is nothing to stop that happening. So it's been presented as this has been for survivors. And that, again, do we know that there was massive amounts of survivors who wanted this to happen? No. But secondary to that, what about administrative records and records that explain how this happened. You know, they're hugely valuable to researchers, academics, you know, not just from a journalistic point of view. And all of these are included for 75 years. And then it also begs the question, what else is going to be, you know,
dumped in the silo?
There's a certain, there's a certain irony to a state that has said, well, we'll make history optional in the junior cert. I know it's a flippant point of me to make, but nonetheless, it sticks in my throat when we look at it and we talk in terms of this state is only less than 100 years old, really. You know, we're not even out of nappies, and we're not even able to look back and say what has happened within people who, as you say, are in their mid 40s and they're walking around now and they can't even know, they potentially can't even know who their mother is, really, because the state, in effect, are making a judgment call that the financial impact of something like this might be too much for us to bear. That is not truth. That is not transparency. And that is not ownership of what we've done. People deserve to be treated as human beings, as individuals, and with respect and dignity. And part of respect and dignity is knowing who you are, you know?
Yeah.
How do we break the deadlock? How do we push forward? Is it just constant publicity?
Well, I mean, I suppose the thing that I can do anyway is to kind of keep
telling the story.
Like, I try to not write about you know, the stories about wonderful reunions after 50 years. While they are amazing, I think how it happened in the first place is more important. Oh, yeah. I mean, and that to me is the story. And too often I think you read the stories of, you know, someone finds a long lost, and I think that's fine, that's great, it's wonderful for them, but it doesn't actually tell us anything about the more insidious side to this, is that how it happened in the first place, which is probably a little bit less sexy in terms of a headline or whatever. But to me, that's the more important aspect of the story. I don't know. I think like there'll have to be some form of a, I hate to say it because, you know, they always seem to be so problematic. But I mean, to address adoption, we have to really, it has to be done forensically. The files have to be opened. It has to be some form of an investigation, hopefully better than how we do things generally with the Commissions of Investigations Act, which I know very learned legal minds have issues with. But I think adoption will have to be addressed separately. I don't think it will be addressed in the Commission's report. I don't know. I know it's part of the remit, but I think it's far bigger than just the mother and baby homes issue. I think it will be a standalone issue in itself. I know there's a scoping exercise into illegal registrations, which again, like I pointed out earlier, like that was announced last May. It was supposed to be due in October. Still not seen it. Word is that it'll be the end of May before we hear what that has thrown up. But then, I mean, what were the terms of reference? I remember asking the department, they wouldn't tell you.
Yeah,
then you know, start to raise. So again, it's all of this thing about what exactly are we actually looking at then? And then they finally put them up on the website. Didn't tell anyone until I was asking again. It was kind of one of my check-ins. And so they're looking at 1% of records. They're only looking at records for which have 21 markers. Now, in the vast majority of illegal birth registrations, they're not going to be marked because whatever the people who were involved in this were, they weren't stupid. If you're breaking the law or facilitating someone to break the law, you tend not to signpost it. So they're not going to find mountains of records like the 126. They were an exception to the rule. Mm. So they're going to find a whole lot of nothing. In my opinion. And second to that, if you're only looking at illegal birth registrations, you're not examining adoption at all, because none of these records resulted in legal adoptions where adoption orders exist. So there's a whole other section that needs to be looked at. So again, it's a kind of a cosmetic exercise so we can say we looked at this and what did we find? I mean, I don't know what it's going to report, but I'd imagine you're not going to get a huge amount of categoric cases because it requires a bit more forensic analysis than that. And we're going to be over a year down the line waiting for a scoping exercise to tell us whether or not we need a full audit, which we already know we do. So,
I mean, but that is, and it's not just in adoption. It's not just in mother and baby homes. That's the game. Scoping exercise, limited terms of reference, very narrow report on the collusions. And basically then you have to revisit again 5 years and you revisit it again in 5 years. And maybe after, well, what are we now? We're 101 years. Maybe after another 101 years, we'll actually get to what the problem is.
Yeah.
I suppose I want to be a bit more optimistic. I think you writing about it actually, it does help. I think it, the fact that you've been writing about it for so long, I know it's got my interest all the time. You know, I know some of the people we've spoken to in here have spoken about that, that it's important that those stories and the narrative, as you said, it will break through. These things come up. It's important that we have these conversations. We need to also put everything in the context of who we are as a state and who we are as a people, because if we aren't going to address this properly, we're looking at a situation where, you know, we had a trouble last year trying to get the last Magdalene Laundry turned into a, we wanted to have it preserved and they wanted to put up a hotel. You know, we can't just continually paper over everything we do in Ireland. And it's important that if we're to grow and actually own our place in the world, we need to know where we came from. And these people need to know where they came from.
It's like it's about owning your kind of national identity in the sense of who we are. And like a big part of our history is this. Mm. Like a huge part of Irish social history is all of this and how we treated women and children. And like my issue with the debate about history in schools, it's got nothing to do whether it should be optional. It should be what we're actually teaching. Because I didn't learn any of this in school, because our history, the only history we celebrate is dead Irish men. Mm. There's nothing about women. I mean, Glasnevin Cemetery has the graves of wonderfully heroic dead Irish men. But I mean, if you take a tour through it with like Claire McGettrick from Justice for Magdalens, she'll start pointing out all Magdalene graves, unmarked graves, graves where women are named on headstones, but they're not in fact there. And you're talking about like, these are women that literally died for what we now know to be feminism and for the advancement of women's rights. Like, as on, you know, they had to go through horrific experiences so that we don't do this shit anymore. You know what I mean? Mm. And we don't learn about that. It's the same with adoption, mother and baby homes, adoption society, all of this stuff. You know, it's not out there. You know, it is, but it's not taught. It's not a part of a history that we want to shout about.
You have
our
to
own.
Seek it out.
Yeah, you know, you do. And I mean, to me, it's another side of Irish social history that we should be attempting to address, but also attempting to teach people and say, like, this is what we did and this is who we are. And it's important that we know this.
But you see, if you did that, you wouldn't get away with homeless hubs. You wouldn't get away with direct provision. If people truly acknowledge the past, then the present wouldn't be happening the way it is. It just wouldn't be.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the shame of kind of when you're, I mean, like, you look at direct provision, like, I've written nothing on direct provision, but yet I've written whatever, all the stuff that I write about, adoption, laundries, mother and baby homes, all the rest. And you're kind of going, like, you know, in 20 years time, I'll probably look back and go, Jesus, I didn't do enough. You
but
know?
It's, all, it's a continuum. It is a continuum. Yeah. These are not, as you say, these are not separate, isolated incidents. This is a continuum that has run since 1916 up to the present date, where women, children are made to suffer because they don't fit some societal norm. Mm. And that's it.
Yeah.
What is the old expression? He who fails to learn from the past is certain to lose the future.
Yeah.
Well, but welcome to the washing machine cycle of wash, rinse and repeat in Ireland, folks.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and having this chat. And you,
no problem.
You came a hell of a distance to have this chat, and we are very grateful that you did. Thank you so much.
Glad to
you will be returning to the Free Republic of Cork this evening.
I will, yeah. Although I'm from Galway, just stress that. Yeah. For anyone thinks I'm from Cork.
You're trapped, but what can you do now? No, Conal, we really appreciate you coming. This is an important lesson for everybody. We should be doing more, Martin. Honestly, we do. We have a little podcast. Bloody hell, these stories need to be given more. They need to be amplified. If you're a bigger platform and you're listening to this, you know what? Reach out and we'll make more connections, and let's get the stories up there, because the only way you do it is if you actually amplify it. They don't listen until they have to listen.
Well, I suppose the scary part is that some of the people that are locked in homeless hubs and that today started out their lives in Magdalene Laundries. And that's just really awful stuff to think about. Thanks again for coming into us.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, folks. Look, do us a favour, head over onto patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We could do with a few bob. It keeps the lights on. The content goes out for free, but you know, trust me, it costs us to produce it.
Honest to God, Tony's at this since 9 o'clock this morning. It's now almost 3 o'clock in the day, and it's hard work.
Talk to y'all soon, folks. Take care. Bye bye.